I have a good friend who keeps sending me things about senior citizens. I have no reason to know why, but he keeps sending them to me, and he sent me one of these that I thought I would share with you. I think it was funny. It may not be funny to you, but I hope you'll find it interesting. The title of it is How to Call the Police When You're Old and Don't Move Fast Anymore. George Phillips, this is a true statement, a true story, I understand. George Phillips, an elderly man from Meridian, Mississippi, was going to bed when his wife told him he left the light on in the garage shed, which you could see from the bedroom window. George opened the back door to go to turn off the light, and he saw there were people in the shed stealing things. He phoned the police, who asked, "Is someone in your house?" And he said, "No, but some people are breaking into my garden shed and stealing from me." Then the police dispatcher said, "All patrols are busy. You should lock your doors, and an officer will be along when one is available." George said, "Okay." He hung up the phone, and he counted to 30. He then phoned the police again. "Hello, I just called you a few seconds ago because there were people stealing things from my shed. Well, you don't have to worry about them now because I just shot and killed them both. And the dogs are eating them up right now." And he hung up. Within 5 minutes, 6 police cars, a SWAT team, helicopters, 2 fire trucks, a paramedic, and an ambulance showed up at the Phillips residence and caught the burglars red-handed. One of the policemen said to George, "I thought you said you shot them." George said, "I thought you said there was nobody available." I have to tell you, I'd love to have seen that one. I have to tell you, I would love to have seen that. Today, I would like to set the foundation for some sermons that you've asked about in the survey that you gave me. After the feast, I have 5 different topics that have been requested that are offshoots of this particular topic, and we'll go over those probably over the next year and a half, but they're basically ideas and thoughts that you have all asked about, so I'd like to simply share that with you. The title of the sermon today is The Seasons of a Marriage. The Seasons of a Marriage. I mentioned to you back a few weeks ago that in the early 60s, Mrs. Armstrong told me something that stayed with me all of these years. She opened up for me a new vista, a new understanding. She talked about the Jewish calendar and the calculations of the 19-year time cycles as found in our solar system. She said that when a feast came early in the fall, that is a Feast of Tabernacles, and then the following year in the spring, the Passover came later, she said what happens because of that intercalary month that is in that Jewish calendar, you would find the winters to be longer and harsher. She was right. I found that in the years that I worked in Canada. Living on the prairies in Canada, we found this to be so. But we also found out that there were 2 weeks that were given to us right after the Feast of Tabernacles when the crops could be brought in before the snows fell. As I mentioned to you, there was a farmer in Saskatchewan who came to the church, and he couldn't go to the Feast of Tabernacles because he said he had to harvest his crops. And I told him God's calendar does work in cycles, and he does seem to give us 2 weeks after the feast. And, of course, as I mentioned, he did not have the faith to go, but he stayed home. It started raining the day we left for the feast, and it did not dry up until the day that we returned and he started to harvest his crops on that particular day. Yet he found there were 2 weeks of grace that was given before the snow set in. Nevertheless, he said he had missed that feast and he will never miss another feast again because he saw the hand of God in the calendar cycles. Well, I found more. I found some profound things that I have studied and looked at, and I want to share them with you today in this particular sermon as we lay a foundation for some other sermons on marriage and family. I found that over the past 40 years, I had the opportunity to read several books. They had a profound effect upon my life and my ministry, and I've shared some of that with the brethren in the Church of God, and I hope today to share it with you as well. I read a book entitled The Seasons of a Man's Life. His name was Daniel J. Levinson. This particular gentleman did research on how an individual grows up and goes through life in these different cycles. Now, his book was very dry. His book was very boring. But there's a lady that wrote a book that she took the material that Levinson had researched and actually put it into a book of her own. And you probably have heard of the book. It was entitled Passages. It was by a lady named Gail Sheehy. And she took her material from Levinson and she spruced it up, as we would say, and she made it into a very interesting book. And a number of people have read that book. It was on the bestsellers list for a long time, some years ago. I found a second book, which was very interesting, entitled Intimate Marriage. Intimate Marriage. It was by a man by the name of Harold Kleinbell and his wife, Charlotte. And that particular book helped me to understand in my premarital counselings and the counselings of brethren in the church through the years that I have ministered some very, very important points, which I'll share with you today in the sermon. There's another book entitled The Marriage Map, and it's by a lady named Maxine Rock. And you will find it also goes into the concept of how when you date and you become engaged and then you get married and what you go through, these are some of the things that you will face. I've come to realize something very, very important, and that is the fact that the Bible shows that there are seasons in a Christian's life. There are seasons in a Christian's life, seasons of festivals and simply seasons of life in growing up, maturing, and growing old. When you read about in the Bible about infants, you read in the Bible about being a babe, you read in the Bible about being a child, a young man or a young woman. Talks about mature people. And then there's a statement that talks about aged ambassadors. So all these different groups of individuals are mentioned in the Bible. But I found an interesting statement that is found in Ecclesiastes 3, and I'd like you to turn there with me to begin the sermon today. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, and it begins in verse 1. And I'll only use probably this one verse, but it opens up all of the rest of the statements, and you probably heard the song, you probably read the scripture. But it says in verse 1 of chapter 3 of Ecclesiastes, to everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under heaven. And so we begin to look at these things and you see that it says a time to be born, a time to die, etc., etc. And it goes through all these different times that an individual might have in their life. But the point was, to everything there is a season and there is a time. It forms the basis for what I would like to say today. Why did God create the cycles and seasons of human life? I've come to realize, and I think many of you in this room have come to realize, there are cycles in human life. You see natural laws at work in the human body. We see natural laws at work on this earth and in our universe. The two laws of thermodynamics are there. And one of them is how the earth is continuously running down. And there's a reason for that. And God has put that in motion for us to understand some principles. Research has shown seasons or changes in a person's life from birth to death. And research has shown seasons or changes in growth from being an infant to being a mature adult. And so we also are going to see that there are seasons in a marriage. There are seasons in a marriage. So what can we learn? What can we learn from all of this? The seasons of a marriage, the cycles and seasons of life are all teachers. They are all teachers. They are instruments of learning if we will learn from them. First, we are learning and adjusting. You continue to learn and adjust. You continue to follow the process of learning to follow and practice the concept of this process of having to face situations and experiences in life where you simply have to adjust to them as you move down this road. We learn adaptability. There's an important point in being adaptable. Being inflexible is impossible in order to get by in life because you simply will be left behind. You will find yourself having greater difficulties if you don't learn how to bend a little bit in certain areas in life instead of breaking. Flexibility. We need to have that ability to flex as well. That's a part of the human life. We need to learn how to work through problems. We need to learn how to work through difficulties that we face. Number two, we are learning to judge righteous judgment. I think one of the greatest places to learn how to judge righteous judgment is with children and teens. I do believe it has been one of the most enjoyable, exciting times for my wife and I, because we learned how to judge righteously, how to handle things. We had to learn how to understand the spirit of what they were going through. And I also will tell you, we had to learn the differences between a boy and a girl in their thinking. And I'm glad we had that opportunity, because it was most unique to understand that we couldn't do everything exactly the same way with both of our children. And some things my son was more sensitive to, some things my daughter was. But I think we began to realize that judging righteous judgment, treating righteously both the mate and the children, taught us how to also deal with the outside world as well. Because mercy and compassion are necessary, but good sound judgment has to be as well. Everything is no longer black and white when your children start growing up. When you get married, not everything is just black and white. And there are many, many judgments that you have to render. Thirdly, when you become a member of God's family, you'll have these good basic tools to help you rule and understand the needs of people. One of the greatest lessons I've ever learned as a pastor is that there are no two people exactly alike. No two people exactly alike. And the realization of that has been very, very helpful. And understanding how we can learn to adapt and how to flex and learning how to judge righteously all put us in good stead for when the kingdom of God comes to this earth and we're responsible for working with people, standing next to them. I think we recognize that we are therefore living in the now, the present time, with an eye toward the future, because all things work together for a good end. What you learn from all of these things is simply coming to a good end. Romans 8:28 says that. We don't need to turn there this afternoon. Number four, last of all, we're learning that success is a direction and not a destination. Therefore, we must understand a major building block is simply the dynamics of marriage, the seasons of a marriage, the seasons of a person's life. And there are adjustments that continue to need to be made as you move through these seasons. Howard Whitman, in the Philadelphia Sun Bulletin, said this about marriage. He said, "It takes guts to stay married. There will be many crises between the wedding day and the golden anniversary." Interesting statement. Realistic statement that is there. The people who make it, he simply said, are heroes. Howard Kleinbell, in the book that I mentioned to you, Intimate Marriage, says the following. He says, "A depth relationship is a living process with its ups and downs, its ebb and flow, its succession of change. Each stage in the marital cycle has its unique demands, its unique frustrations, its unique worries, its unique joys, and its unique satisfactions. At every stage, the demands of each partner are different. The pattern of needs change from stage to stage, altering the nature and the intensity of the will to relate. There is no peace," it's his statement, "in human relationships. No marriage is ever settled." Now, it doesn't mean no peace from the wrong point of view. It means simply that there is a continuous movement. He says, "Marriage never needs to be dull. Just when a couple has mastered the skill of one stage or given up, or becomes bored, a new and unprecedented stage arrives requiring the acquisition of new skills." Yes, and sometimes they happen before you have a chance to even recognize they're happening. When all of a sudden your children start asking you questions at age 10, 11, and 12 that you have to suck air and say, "Oh boy, I got to answer that question." And of course, you know what some of those questions were and are. So we recognize the periods, he said, going on in the quote, "The periods of transition from one stage to another can be occasions of pressure and crisis, As the couple struggles to get hold of the familiar, comfortable past and master the demands of the new stage. And sometimes you can't hang on to some things from way back there when you get over here. What do you mean, the dynamics of marriage is asked? Dynamics is simply a pattern of change or growth of an object or a phenomenon. There are variations and contrast in force and intensity marked by the continuous activity, productive or otherwise, or change. These are things that are going on. These are things that we have to understand as we work with a husband or with a wife, with children, and then, of course, outside of that, with brethren that we work with. Robert McIver wrote this particular statement. He said, "Time is the greatest of all human mysteries. The way we respond to the challenge of time is a test of really what we are, of what we are becoming. We grow older day by day. Does that fact disturb us greatly, little, or sometimes, often? How else are we growing in the same time? For life is and has this unique energy possessed of sensitivity and perceptiveness that makes for itself a web of relationships, thus binding its past to its future." Meaning that you learn through time. You recognize that what you learned back then you bring forward here to be able to use it, hopefully to build on, to make proper and right judgments. He goes on to say, "Time changes all things, including the person that we are. We pass through the seasons of life. Time creates a force of change. Society creates a force of change. Finances create a force of change. Weather creates a force of change. Bodily functions create a force of change. Mental attitudes and education create a force for change. Two different human beings living together creates a force for change. It just does. All are subject to and created by time, and time never stands still for you. Time never stands still for me. We are forced to make decisions, make judgments, make choices, and no decision is a decision. It just is. It just is when you begin to understand it. It's like love for God. It's never accomplished once and for all, but is only for the day that we have in front of us. As it says in the book of Matthew, chapter 6, don't worry about tomorrow, because tomorrow will take care of itself. I think we see that in the Christian commitment, like love and trust in God, it is a commitment to be acted out in everyday activities. And the concept of a season of marriage is very much important in this regard. He goes on to say, he said, "In all of life's seasons, in all of life's moods, we decide for or against our marriage, not only by what we think and feel, but also by what we do. Therefore, there is the stuff of life, and we make or we break commitments." Time. Let's look at it just for a moment. Time is described by some people as the passage of physical bodies through space. That is one definition. Another definition is the measured or measurable period during which an activity, process, or condition exists or continues. Time is an appointed, fixed, or customary moment or hour for something to happen, to begin or end. Time is finite. It is a finite duration, as distinguished from infinite, or infinite as we used to say. It's an earthly duration as opposed to eternity. God dwells in eternity. We dwell in time. That's why time has no effect on Him. That's why time has an effect on us. Ecclesiastes told us, as we read here, "To everything there is a season and a time for every purpose under heaven." I think time is very interesting. It's very curative. It's like good wine. It takes time to mature. And you never drink good wine before it's time. I mean, that was an ad that was on television some years ago when we were in Canada. "Drink no wine before it's time," I think was the statement that was made. But it is. It's curative. And good wine is like that. And also we recognize the good cheese is the same way. The good cheese is curative. It's also creative when you begin to look at the Grand Canyon. The Grand Canyon was made in time. Some people think it was made just like that. But if you go back and you look at how time factored into the movement of water through that area, the winds and all of the things that made it, it has been made over millions and billions of years that God created it. And therefore, you see, it's created like the Grand Canyon. But it's corrupting too. It's corrupting too because it plays upon the creation. And everything, if we really understand it, is running down. And God says He's going to fold up the earth someday and He's going to recreate. Why? Because we simply are seeing it run down. So we have to understand those are all things that are playing upon us as human beings. Time changes all things, including the person that we are. We pass through the seasons of life. Time never stands still. Time pushes you through these passages or these doors into a new experience. Secondly, we find there's choice. There's choice. The law of sowing and reaping. The law of sowing and reaping, we recognize, is always at work. No matter what you do, that particular law is the law of laws. It has been there. It has never changed. It is going to smack you if you go against it. It's going to bless you if you follow it. It's just that simple. Christian commitment, like love and trust in God, is a commitment that is acted out in everyday activities. In all seasons of life, in all life's moods, we decide for or against. In this case, I'm talking about today, our marriage. Not only by what we think and feel, but also by what we do. Therein is the stuff of life that we face. This is a lifelong task. It never ends until, in fact, death does us part. That's the way it is. I'm not trying to be morbid. I'm being realistic. And I think we have to be that. The third aspect of this is decision. Christian marital commitment is a growing commitment which matures and deepens as time and life multiplies our experiences. Let me repeat that. Christian marital commitment is a growing commitment which matures and deepens as time and life multiplies our experiences. A depth relationship is a living process. It has its ups, it has its down, it has its ebb, it has its flow. It's continuing succession of change, which you can't stop. And so we have to understand that each stage in a marriage has its unique demands. It has its unique frustrations, its worries, its joys, its satisfactions. Love is something that matures. Love is something that matures as a result of years of mutual cooperation between two people. The sharing of good times and bad, emotionally flat and unrewarding periods are sometimes inevitable. To put it another way, there's sometimes some really boring times. And then there's some times that are really exhilarating times. Almost every relationship has an emotional crisis at one time or another. I'll repeat that for you, because it's important in what we're going to talk about today. Almost every relationship has an emotional crisis at one time or another. Two persons who marry should recognize that the first flush of physical attraction is far from being the full fruition of love. The initial pleasure comes easy. Deeper and more lasting pleasures take time. Now, with that in mind, let's look at the chart that I gave you today. Let's interpret it for you, and then we'll start walking you through it. I drew this particular chart for a very important reason. I wanted you to see something visual about the seasons of a marriage. Let me explain the chart to you. Across the top, it says there are categories. You see there's a line that's drawn down. The first line, it says courtship. The second line over to the right is engagement. And then the third one is wedding to first pregnancy, above the line and below the line. Then the fourth one is preschool children. Then the next one is school children. Then you come to parents of adolescents, children leaving home, empty nest to retirement, and retirement to the death of one. So we're moving through those particular periods, and I will say simply here at this particular juncture that not every section will apply to every last person, but you're going to find a whole lot more will apply than don't. Now we take the second thing, and that is you see this line. And that particular line which says courtship, engagement, marriage, and early marriage, that is what I describe as what we call simply reality. That is reality. And the second line, which is the dotted line that you see going across and then up, 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 almost to perfection, if we looked at the top of the list, which is not really, that is idealism. That is idealism. And what we see is that there are two different understandings. One is reality, and the other one is idealism. You have to move from idealism to reality at some particular time. I will show you where sometimes it sets in, and then I will show you how we begin to see the reaction to it and how people have to work with it. Now, with it, you notice in the middle part of the paper, it says, add the following. Death. Now, what do I mean by death? I'm speaking of premature death. Sickness. Job or financial reversals, miscarriage, sexual dysfunction and changes of life, menopause, conversion, trials and tests from God, injury, disability, and barriers to marital intimacy will come out. All of these things are a part of what sometimes plays on some, not all. But these things do play upon the seasons of a marriage. Now, I also, if you'll notice down below, as we get down to the bottom, you notice there's a little X, and I said second stage. And when you get down right about here, it says when reality begins to set in. That in reality is simply my drawing to show the difference between idealism and reality, but also the fact is that you may be going higher on that line when you finally get over to the end. But my point is to show the difference between idealism and reality. So we want to look at this because we want to evaluate how we deal with these things and how we understand them and why we may be going through certain things and why we may have gone through certain things that we didn't even understand that we were going through. So that's what we're going to do today. Now, let's go to Genesis 2:24. Let's go to Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24. This is the beginning statement about marriage. Chapter 2 and verse 24, it says, therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. A very simple statement, but it's packed with understandings that need to come. First of all, you see, it's a man and a woman. So anything else is contrary to what the Word of God said it should be. Anything else is sin. Anything else is described in other places in the Bible as wrong. So we see, first and foremost, that a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined, as it says here, or cling to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. I thought it's interesting that the Hebrew word here, and we'll come back to it in just a moment, is actually translated in the original Hebrew as cling. So he shall cling to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Leaving and cleaving, becoming one flesh. Marriage grows through becoming one flesh, not sexually, as you see the opening, beginning concept, but beyond that, because that particular act only leads you to what should be actually being done, and that is by living and working together uniquely, as it says here, becoming one flesh. It becomes a spiritual thing, it becomes a mental thing, it becomes an emotional thing. The people begin to be drawn together in that way. Now let's go over to Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 21. There's a scripture here that we would not have read this way back 50 years ago. I'm going to walk into it and hopefully not get in trouble. But it has to do with a principle that we sometimes misunderstand. This is chapter 5 and verse 21. So I'm warning you ahead of time, Be ready for what I'm going to say in this particular regard. Notice what it says, submitting to one another in the fear of God. A simple statement. It comes before we get into things about the wives submitting to your own husbands as unto the Lord. The husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church. Therefore, as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their husbands in everything. This comes before that set of scriptures. Do we know why? Submitting to one another is because of the fact that each has needs in the season of a marriage. Each has needs in the season of a marriage. You have to understand that. We are never disrespecting the authority that God has set in the family. We are coming to understand that there's a broader need to understand the needs that may occur within a marriage that the husband has to submit to or that the wife has to submit to outside of the government. When we understand that, it becomes a most important concept for us to follow, because you have to be sorting and sifting and evaluating and understanding each other and your needs. There were needs that my wife had at a certain time in our marriage. There were needs that I had at a certain time in our marriage. There were needs that our children had at a certain time in our marriage. You had to look at those as a part of the overall plan. And this is what God is telling us here in verse 21. Submitting to one another in the fear of God. Learning how to work together. It's a very important point as we examine eight stages or seasons of a marriage. Once again, not everybody goes through the same stages in the same way. And I can honestly say that if I sat down with the Meekers or with the Buchanans or with a number of other people, I think they would probably come to some of the same things, and they would probably come to some other differing things, some things that they went through that I didn't, some things that I went through that they might not have. But the point is, I think if you will listen to those people who have been through them, you will see that it is a true thing that I'm talking about, the seasons of a marriage. So let's start. Let's look at the map now that you've got in front of you called that diagram and look at stage one, okay? And we'll just go through it lightly. We're not going to touch on all of them because we'll get back to that in the sermons that I'm planning, or at least that I'm working on right now for the coming year on marriage and family. Stage one, courtship and engagement. Dating, learning to relate to people of the opposite sex, companionship and communication. It's coming to break a barrier and beginning to get to know people on a superficial basis. I use that term on a superficial basis, but it's a time of getting to know you. It's a time of exploring male and female likenesses and differences. I do believe this statement is true. Most dating takes place in leisure time. Discovering how a person relates outside of this particular situation, I think you will find that probably the ability for them to understand each other is found 90% in marriage and 10% in dating. I do believe you will find that what you come to understand about your mate will come after you're married to them. Now, we try to have few surprises when we start counseling people in premarital counseling. We try to have as few surprises as possible. But it's impossible to understand some things because the deepest part of our being doesn't always come out before we marry someone. Dating and being in that place of relating to people of the opposite sex, the companionship and the communication is simply something that stays at that 10% if it is that much. I used to give a test entitled the Taylor-Johnson Temperament Analysis Test. We were not trained in Ambassador College to counsel for marriage. That's not a put-down, please understand. That is just simply a fact of life. Premarital counseling, I had to go to school to learn how to do it. And I went to school to learn how to take this particular test and to apply it and to give it to people to take. But what it did, it gave you all the different principles of an individual's life and who they were, where they were when it comes to being an extrovert, an introvert, how their feelings were so far as being peaceful or angry, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all these different things. Then I said to them, take it on your mate to be married to. And it was so interesting. Did you know that the women knew more about the men they were going to marry than the men knew about the women they were going to marry? I found that shocking. Of course, I found out after 52 years of marriage, that's still true. You know, that sort of thing. My wife tells me things that are I didn't know about myself. Well, let's put it this way. Sometimes I just deny, you know, that sort of thing. As you get older, you get stubborn. I don't know what it is, but I think, as my wife says, you're like your father. And I said, oh, Lord, deliver me, you know, that sort of thing. But you do, you know, you just come to recognize that. But it was interesting that we had those two. Now, we give a new test now entitled Prepare and Enrich. And it's a wonderful test because it gives you the ability to know what each person said about their life before, what they went through, et cetera, all their experiences. And their answers show where they are. And so what you do is you sit down with the couple and you say, okay, this is what you believe. This is what you believe. This is a little bit of a difference between each other. Therefore, we call these in the particular test growth opportunities. Growth opportunities. Now, what does that mean? It means simply to discuss the differences. Why do you feel the way you feel? And the interesting thing is that I give them 6 weeks to 3 months to sit down with the test and say, okay, don't go to the show. Don't sit your face in front of that stupid television set. Turn it off. Sit down at a table and ask the question, why do you feel the way you do? Why do I feel the way I do? And it's an amazing thing that happens. They begin to understand why he thinks the way he does, why she thinks the way she does, and then they already have to start making some adjustments along the way. The objective of the test is less surprises, fewer surprises. And, you know, then you won't have a man or a woman saying to their wife or to their husband 14, 16, 18 years after they were married, you know, you're never going to change. And the fact is probably he won't. And so sometimes I say, got to get over it somehow. You know, sometimes you got to do that. And then you have to make adjustments according to what needs to be. But this stage one, this courtship and engagement is priceless because if you use it properly, it will give you 6 months, 8 months, a year to be able to look at some of these answers or look at some of these things and sort. I have to tell you that going to a movie, sitting in front of a television all the time as a date just doesn't work. I love the dates where people sit for hours and talk about their feelings and their thoughts about life and all these things and just begin to lay them out before the other person. It's part of what this Prepare and Enrich is able to help an individual do. Let's go on to stage two. I spent too much time there, but anyway, you see what I'm talking about. Stage two is getting married to the first pregnancy. Now let's go over to Deuteronomy chapter 24. Let's go here for a moment. People don't always understand why Deuteronomy 24 says what it says. But it's a very, very good scripture for a very important reason. This is chapter 24 and verse 5. It says, when a man has taken a new wife, he shall not go out to war or be charged with any business. He shall be free at home 1 year to bring happiness to his wife whom he has taken. I think old King James, doesn't it say, cheer up his wife? I think that's what at least I think that's what somebody's shaking their head. That's what's in your Bible. Why? Is she sad? No. That's not the point. The point that is found here is the fact that this is the period of time when each partner must effect emotional separation from his or her family. Each begins to learn to accept the rule of a husband and the rule of a wife. Did you hear my words I just used? This is not an equal marriage, but I'm talking about the fact of coming to identify this period of time where that you gain a sense of identity and the rule of a husband and the rule of a wife, where they enter into that marriage to begin to be bound closer and closer together. Together, the partners gain a sense of personal identity. They become a family unit over and above their identity as separate individuals. This is a period of time when we-ness should step in instead of I-ness, because the world revolves around us all the time. It's called selfishness. Now, we let the other person in the empirical self. We let our father and mother or our some of our families into that circle. But basically, self is amazing. But the point is, you begin to gain a sense of identity as a family unit instead of just working as an individual, separate individual. Accomplishing these developmental tasks should be something we need to do, and it may be difficult at first to do that. Reality, as I pointed out in the chart there, usually sets in stage two of that particular chart. It's been described by religious writers in some of their books like two rivers that come together. Two rivers that come together. And he said, when the two rivers come together, while they seem to be moving slowly and quietly toward each other, when they meet, you see a roiling and a boiling, and you see rapids that occur and the movement within the water as those two come together. And he said, many times this is the way that it is in this particular stage. And so an individual has to come down to earthly matters of living together, of compromising many of the differences, and working out reasonable need satisfaction. My wife came from the South. She came from Dallas, Texas. I came from the south side of Chicago. Good night, folks. We met at Ambassador College. And both of us had to make a number of what I call compromising differences that needed to be worked out. Everything from what we ate I won't go there. I just leave that one alone. I won't go there. But I'm understanding black eyed peas. I'm understanding greens. Sort of. After 52 years. But we laugh about it. But nevertheless, you compromise the many differences in working out reasonable need satisfaction. That is, ways of communicating and relating are found at this time. And you start learning how to talk differently to each other. Now, claims on time and affection, modification in relationships with self and others, changes, different patterns, or need for closeness or distance, major reorientation, works to shape the unique image of the kind of marriage you want. And it changes something that I found was most interesting. In the early years of being in the ministry, I remember going to a person's home, and they were having marital problems, and we just didn't know what to do. But we came into the home and they showed us around, and the woman showed us the bedroom and she said, "This is my bedroom." I wanted to say, "Well, where does he sleep?" You know, that sort of thing. But the point was, it was what the furniture she bought, this is what she wanted, this is the way she wanted the bedroom, and it was her bedroom. It wasn't their bedroom. And then I began to realize what I was beginning to deal with. And of course, we tried to be kind and helpful in that particular way. But the point is that you see this. You see the we-ness that needs to begin to take place instead of the I-ness. And I use that term for you. Stage three. Look at it. It says, parents of preschool children. I think this is most interesting because we develop a community of experiences which set the marriage apart, and it produces that we-ness in a greater sense of marriage identity. Having a baby imposes many strains on the husband and wife intimacy. The periods of pregnancy involve various coping mechanisms. When my wife and I went out into the field to work in Edmonton, we didn't have a trainee to work with me to go visit widows and to visit women at home whose husbands were not members of the church. And my wife had to go with me. We had a son 2 years of age. We had a daughter. Or was he three at that time? I'm trying to remember now. I don't even remember those things. But she was very small. And I remember that she had to go with me. Now, we wanted to tell the headquarters back in those days, we need two salaries because Richard should have one and so should his wife because she's working as well. And we laugh about it, but they said, no, women don't work in the church. They go with their husbands, and therefore she went with me many, many days. Now, we'd come home about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and guess what would happen? She'd go straight to the diaper pail, and she'd start washing clothes. And I went into the kitchen, and I started to prepare a meal. And this is the way we did it. Because I had a little bit more experience, I didn't burn water by this particular time in my life. We started to find that I would help her. And what we had to do was we had to impose upon ourselves a different routine. And what we did was we found that by doing that, we were able to get through this period of time. But I can tell you that pregnancy involved for my wife morning sickness, and so we had to make adjustments. We had to make adjustments in visiting. We had to do all of those things. But we also took our children with us in the early years when they were small because we had to. But the point was we learned that that was important. We learned how to work our way through. So you have these various periods of time that you go through. Some are easier, some are harder. As I often say, overinvesting in children and underinvesting in marriage sometimes needs to have us reinvent the courtship or recourtship to keep love central in a family life. What my wife and I used to do is when the children would go to school on Monday, which was supposed to be, well, they told us back in those days, well, you can take Monday off if you want to. I mean, usually we were dead on Monday morning, so we were not good for much of anything. But as soon as you get your book work done, you could have the rest of the day off. And so we used to go out and have lunch together, and then we go to a mall or someplace and do some shopping because we needed that. But we also did something else, too, and that was we said we were going to go out and have a date. We were going to have a babysitter, a competent person to take care of our small children while we went and spent some time alone somewhere to do something in an evening every 4, 5, 6 weeks. And that was important to us because we recognized the importance of keeping love central in the family life. This is where you have to learn how to begin to make the adjustments in your life. So key point, a key point, and that is just simply the statement that I made, and that is developing a community of experiences which set the marriage apart and produces that we-ness in that identity. Stage four, school-age children. This is something that I found most helpful. Moving into the experience as a family, as was talked about in the sermonette today, just are priceless because this is what needs to be. Boys need male action with their fathers. Girls need female action with their mothers. My son and I used to play hockey in the hallway of the house. Now, what kind of hockey was that? A marble, and we each had a ruler. And he had this end, that was his goal, and this was my end. And we would play back and forth like that. And he would just love it when he put a shot past me. He got dad, you know, that sort of thing. That's fine. I live with that. He let me do it. I let him do it once, you know, that sort of thing over the many years. I'm only kidding. I'm not serious. But this is some of the things we would do. We would also do things as a girl with her mother. And I think we see this female action with mother, this male action with the father, and then you cross over. Now, my daughter still does the same thing today. When she has a situation of a certain type, she calls mom. When she has a certain type of other situation, she calls dad. Because she knows this is where she'll get this from dad, this is where she'll get this from mom. Jonathan does the same thing. He does the same thing. He called me the other day and he said, okay, tell me what I should speak on the sixth or the seventh day of the feast. And he gave me two topics and I said, I don't know. He said, great help you are, Dad. So I went back. I said, let me think about it for a while. I said, let's find out where the themes are going. But the point is that we see we've established that. I think one of the most exciting experiences was when Jonathan became a teenager. We took him hunting with us over in British Columbia, in a place called Prince George. And there were two cow mooses racing up the side of a hill. They were crashing and bashing to get away from us. Now, we couldn't shoot them because they were out of season. His eyes were that big. He said, Dad, I've never seen anything that big in the forest. And I said, yeah, and you try to find them, too. I mean, that's almost impossible as well. They know how to hide. But the point was that these are things that the children never forget. These are things they never forget. So you have this stage four school-age children, and then you come to stage five, parents of adolescents. These are probably sometimes difficult years because the maturity of a young person is coming. Consistent investment pays off with your children, and it also pays off between you and your mate. Neglect, of course, in this area creates separation. I think we see that couples sometimes face pressures and conflicts in stage five as children grow up. Sometimes a conflict between an adolescent and a parent can easily raise barriers between parents because, go ask your father, and they don't always like that, and so they try to play one against the other, and I think this happens sometimes. But nevertheless, this time of life, I find, was the most exciting for us because we found ourselves having an ability to reason with our children at a dinner table on Friday night. There was one interesting time when my daughter came home and she was very angry. And she said to all of us at the dinner table that night, she says, "I hate her." And I said, "No, you don't. You dislike what she did." "Yeah, I hate her." I said, "No, you dislike what she did." "Yeah, Dad, I hate her." I said, "No, Adrian, that's not what you mean." But the point was, it took a little bit of time for her to understand you dislike the act, but you're not supposed to hate the person. And it was a great, interesting time. But it made you realize that these are things that the children wanted to work through, and they did work through, and you appreciate the ability for them to do that. Now, as your children become adolescents, you'll find that they like to do things with their friends more than they like to do things with mom and dad sometimes. And they have their friends that they have, and they that sort of thing. And you have to understand that some activities you're beginning to do without your children. I hate to say it, but this is generally the time of life when you begin to go to pot. I don't mean the stuff that people smoke. I'm talking about the stuff where you grow in grace and knowledge in the front and various and sundry other places, and people begin to see the muscles begin to become, soft, and people begin to allow themselves to do some things. And you have to realize that you need to give more attention to personal appearance. And you need to work on those things, because this is the time when children are beginning to be sprung from home, that you need to have new hobbies, new interests, new skills to keep growing as a person. This is what we found in many, many cases with individuals. Demands begin to move from children to each other. And this is where you have to realize it is the concept of simply the empty nest. It's the children beginning to leave home. Now, just for a moment, let me give you something that before we come to stage six, which you see on your chart there, it says parents of children leaving home. Before then, you had what we call the first stage, making one's place, the establishment of an individual in their job, the raising of a family, these things, making one's place in the sense of a family, an individual kingdom, as we call it, where you have in that kingdom your place and what you're doing, your setup, your approach to all these things. And then the second thing you have within that is the establishment of a job and the raising of a family. When you move into stage number six, you have what we call the second aspect, and that is the developmental stage of the second half of your life. And it means simply that you need to develop some things that you may have neglected, such as your inner resources. This may be the time when you stop and smell the roses. This may be the time that you look at some things that you haven't looked at. This was the time when I saw people coming to the crisis of middle age. The crisis of middle age. What we found at this particular period of time, that there were things such as female and male menopause. Some people don't believe in it. Some people will say, "Nah, that's baloney for a woman to have female menopause." And there's also the fact that they don't believe that there is a male menopause as well. But there is in many, many cases. I do believe that the crisis of middle years, if people are not recognizing these things, are only going to be hurtful. Because if people have used their children as their primary way of relating, or using it as a means of avoiding intimacy, it creates a whole new problem. And you have to realize that as you begin to spring your children, you may create a vacuum when the children leave home. It's called the empty nest syndrome. And you will find that it's there. It's for real. And we found that the one thing that we missed greatly was that Friday night meal, where we each had a choice once a month to have the meal and what dessert we wanted and that sort of thing. And we all did that every month. And when our children left home, when they finally did, we found one very, very interesting thing happened, and that is we couldn't go into that dining room for 2 years. Oh, we went there when we invited people over for dinner, but we couldn't go there just the two of us because of that particular reason. So we recognize that there is this sort of thing. Now, when you get to this particular period of time, you see the loss of hair, you see the loss of teeth, you see the loss of vitality, you see the loss of youthful appearance, rapid recuperative powers, declining physical attraction, and then some trying to find the fountain of youth. All of these things are things that sometimes you have to realize are happening to many, many people, and you have to think about what's happening. The biggest thing that happened during this time were aging parents and the loss of my parents when they both died during this particular period of time. I had an uncle that died at age 86, and my sister called to tell me, Uncle so-and-so just died. He died at age 86. And the second statement out of her mouth was, you are the patriarch of the family. I said, what? I'm next in line to die then. I said, Eileen, how can you say that to me? I'm next in line to die. If I'm the patriarch of the family, you know, that sort of thing. But, you know, it's interesting to see what you go through. Now, I got over it, I think. But the point was, I'm trying to show you something that's interesting that happens. You go through these things. But aging parents and the loss of parents, and then, of course, the thing like my uncle, I am now next in line. I am the oldest in the family now. And sometimes, you know, that can present some problems. There are people also that when they lose their parents, they have unresolved guilt because they didn't do anything about what they should have done. They had a bad relationship with mom or dad or both of them, and they feel very bad. The nice part about the second resurrection is the fact, like one man said, I think it was in Indianapolis one day, he said, oh, yeah. He said, I've got some unfinished business. Nice word. Because he realized he did some very foolish things. So we see that these are things that you have to work your way through. Stage number 7, the emptiness to retirement. The emptiness to retirement. That means that you simply are moving into a different situation. We do things as a couple we always said we wanted to do, but thought we could not do because of the time needed for children. And time seems to fly by a whole lot faster during this stage. In fact, I do know it flies faster at this particular stage. And I think some of you in this room probably feel it does too. Now you have grandparenting that comes along at this time. This is wonderful. Some people have figured that they would really wish they could have gone right to grandparenting and forget about what they had to go through with having children. But this one I like because it's the time you pay back your children by spoiling theirs. It's really nice. My son will turn 50 the first day of the feast. And if he wasn't having his birthday on the first day of the feast, we were thinking up some really bad things to do to him. You know, just for fun. Because now you get your kid. In actuality, we weren't going to do it, but we thought about, you know, what we thought, well, maybe have a man dress up in an undertaker suit and come to the house on his birthday and sing happy birthday to him. And somebody said, oh, you got to be kidding. And I said, yeah, I probably am. But we laugh about that because we recognize that we do have grandchildren, and you do enjoy grandchildren in a different way from your children. You love your children, but I think it's interesting. Reinvesting in second careers, new hobbies, couple projects, avoiding ingrownness or self-absorption become very, very important. That is, at this particular stage, that you'll find that some major problems occur. There are elderly people that suffer from suicide because of depression. There are some elderly people that go to drinking. We have found that this can be a problem. So we recognize that these are things to be watching for. But a need to stay in touch with the world of growth and challenges, the superhighway of knowledge, overload, that's all a part of it. and I use the term not becoming a dinosaur totally. And I relate to that in certain ways. I think probably as some of you might as well. Stage number 8, you see that on your chart. It says retirement to the death of one spouse. Making the most of the time you have together. By now you know how precious they are. The need to support each other in adjusting to retirement. I think preparing to help each other to live as a widow or a widower and strengthening the inner resources that we have. I think these are all of the ones that I want to cover today, because I have about 7 or 8 principles that I can give, but we're already at the 1 hour mark, and I think we'll leave it at that for today, and after the feast we'll come back to start touching on some of those. We've reviewed today simply the stages of marriage and intimacy with its own set of needs, its own set of possibilities. We can see it cultivates some very powerful qualities through time, through choice and experience. I hope you'll find what I gave you is helpful to understand. If you're younger, some of the things you want to be looking for. If you're older, I think some of the things that you didn't have happen, some of the things you do relate to. But I think I hope it will be as helpful to you as it has been to my wife and I over the past 52 years of marriage. So hopefully it's a good beginning to what we want to cover as we move into the fall after the Feast of Tabernacles, and hopefully it will be a refresher when we get there with some of the things we've said today.